All right, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's seminar on Taiwan's role in countering CCP political warfare. My name is Russell Hsiao. I'm the Executive Director of the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to policy research and analysis. Launched only in 2016, our mission is to enhance the U.S.-Taiwan relationship by contributing to a more informed public discussion about Taiwan here in the United States and around the world. Towards that end, we undertake several major programs that include a bi-weekly publication featuring timely analysis about Taiwan, public seminars about Taiwan, an annual symposium on U.S.-Taiwan relations, fellowship opportunities, as well as cultural programs. Before we begin today's program, I would also like to thank the continued support of our co-founders, board members, advisors, staff, as well as our interns. I especially want to thank Richard Haddock and the Seeger, and our co-sponsor for today's event, the Seeger Center for Asian Studies, which is a university research institute and the academic home of the Asian Studies program of the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University. Its mission is to increase the quality and broaden the scope of scholarly research and publication on Asia, promote U.S.-Asian scholarly interaction, and educate a new generation of students, scholars, analysts, and policymakers. The center, founded in 1991 out of the Sino-Soviet Institute, was named for Gaston Seeger, Jr., a Japan specialist with a long career at the George Washington University, the National Security Council, and the U.S. Department of State, formerly serving as U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs from 1986 to 1989. So let's begin. The Trump administration's national security strategy, released in December 2017, issued a clear warning, and I quote, "State and non-state actors project influence and advance their objectives by exploiting information, democratic media freedoms, and international institutions. Repressive leaders often collaborate to subvert free societies and corrupt multilateral organizations," end quote. While Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. elections has commanded a lion's share of the public attention, the Chinese Communist Party is engaged in a comprehensive, coercive campaign that utilizes political warfare to influence and undermine democracies through various means. To be sure, there are imminent challenges from Russia's overt and covert interferences in the American political process. Yet the demographic, economic, and military challenges associated with China's rise and its rise in sharp power arguably presents a far more complex and strategic long-term challenge to the United States and Asian democracies. A hard look at how revisionist authoritarian powers exert its influence on the United States is necessary and long overdue. It's necessary not only because it's something people need to be concerned about, but also because it is essential that the U.S. government and American society address the issue with the appropriate, precise, and nuanced legal as well as policy responses. This is also a challenge that many democracies are facing. The rise of China's authoritarian influence is being felt throughout the world, most notably in Australia, Canada, Czech Republic, New Zealand, United States, and of course, Taiwan. It's worth pointing out that while Western countries are only coming to grips with this challenge, this seemingly mystic challenge, the government in Taiwan has the longest experience contending with CCP influence operations. In particular, Taiwan represents an important case study of CCP United Front activities, something that Chinese President Xi Jinping has called CCP's magic weapon and broader influence operation. Given the history of the Chinese Civil War and the strategic importance of the Taiwan issue for CCP leaders, Taiwan remains the United Front's number one priority. As a result of this long history, Taiwan also has the most intimate understanding of CCP United Front and political warfare operations. This is not only an issue of the past, but also the present. Most recently, just in mid-June, Taiwan prosecutors indicted the spokesman for a small political party, the New Party, and two other members for allegedly seeking to recruit Taiwan military officers on behalf of China and violating the country's National Security Act. Taiwan's national security apparatuses have also identified and made public cases in which content farms in the PRC were spreading fake news in Taiwan, especially during the height of social tensions, political tensions, as those over the military pension reforms. Just last week, the website of Taiwan's ruling DPP administration was hacked by most likely Chinese hackers. With the local elections coming up in Taiwan this November, there are also heightened concerns of Chinese election meddling. The motivations for Beijing are certainly there. All this to say that this is a shared challenge that necessitates a shared response. To help us better understand the who, what, how, and why of CCP political warfare, we're delighted to have been able to assemble our all-star panelists today to help us draw some clear lines around these issues. The difficulty, of course, is that their clear lines are very hard to draw. To my immediate left, I have Toshi Yoshihara, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Previously, he held the John A. Van Buren Chair of Asia-Pacific Studies at the U.S. Naval War College, where he taught strategy for over a decade. He is also the recipient of the Navy Meritorious Civilian Service Award in recognition of his scholarship on maritime and strategic affairs at the Naval War College. To his left, we have Bethany Ellen Ibrahim, who is a security reporter at the Daily Beast and previously a contributing reporter at Foreign Policy. She was previously an assistant editor at Foreign Policy's China Channel, Tea Leaf Nation. She has appeared on CNN, C-SPAN, BBC, Al Jazeera, and a number of other international media outlets. She was a 2017 Arthur F. Burns Fellow in Berlin, a 2016 Jefferson Fellow at the East-West Center, and a 2015 fellow with the International Reporting Project, among other postings. Last but not least, we have Shanti Kalatil. Did I get that right, hopefully? Is director of the International Forum for Democratic Studies at the National Endowment for Democracy. Previously in her career, she served as senior democracy fellow at USAID, an associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, an associate with the Carnegie the study of diplomacy at Georgetown University, and as a consultant at World Bank. And she was also a Hong Kong-based reporter for the Wall Street Journal Asia. So in keeping with the format of our public seminars, I prepared a set of questions that I will present to each of the panelists. I invite the panelists to engage one another in the questions that they're presented with, and we will try to leave around 15 minutes at the end for audience Q&A. Well, to kick us off and set the context, because Toshi, you've written the most recent report and a very important, I think, contribution to the literature on this issue on countering comprehensive coercion, competitive strategy against authoritarian political warfare. I want to start off with you. Okay, so what are the CCP's approaches to political warfare, and how do they serve the party's goals? I think I recall in your report that you draw a distinction between offensive and defensive political operations. What are the distinctions, and why do they matter when we talk about when we try to understand political warfare?
Sure. So what I'm actually going to do is make a couple of points.
Okay.
On the United Front Work Department, which is really one of many organs that wages political warfare. And then to use that as a window into Chinese political warfare writ large. So, as I said, the United Front Work Department is one of many institutions, including the Propaganda Department, the International Liaison Department, a variety of associations and federations associated with overseas Chinese. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs also is a key actor that provides cover for a lot of these political operatives. The Ministry of State Security, the Ministry of Public Security, and of course the PLA. Which, of course, has subsumed many of their three warfare's activities under this new body called the Strategic Support Force. So I just want to make clear that the United Front Work Department that I'll be talking about today is really one of many institutions. It's really an architecture. It's a constellation of actors that pushes China's aims. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that Xi elevated the United Front Work Department back in 2015. Mm-hmm. And I think this is important that he put his own personal capital in raising the strategic profile of the department. And he held a work conference. It was the first time in nearly a decade. And created a leading group. He's created all sorts of leading groups. Well, this is one of them. This is one of the leading groups of which he is chair, overlooking the interagency process in running the United Front. He issued regulations that was considered to be the party's first rule. that would govern United Front activities. And then the institution got a further boost back in March of 2018 after the National People's Congress basically allowed the United Front Work Department to absorb other state functions related to United Front. And so I think the first thing that I would say is that the United Front is clearly a institution. It's a bureaucratic organization, but it's also a concept, an idea that emerged in the very early parts of the Chinese Communist Party's history. And it's also a series of tactics that form together to essentially serve a larger strategy and larger Chinese aims. So let me get back to your question mm-hmm. about what are the party's goals, right? Mm-hmm. What's the goal of the United Front? And I think the United Front and all other organizations that pursue political warfare have very simple goals, I think. It's firstly, primarily, to keep the party in power and to promote the party's most important goals. And for the United Front Work Department, it includes things like promoting the China Dream, which is the so-called great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. In the United Front's own formulation, it's really about winning over as many people as possible that support the party, and to reduce as many people as possible that oppose the party. And its mission is to befriend, entice, monitor, infiltrate, co-opt, coerce, various peoples and groups that fall outside of the umbrella of the party. And so the Work Department in particular has a set of targets that it goes after in order to support those goals. Those include people that don't belong to the party, the intelligentsia, ethnic minorities, religious groups, the private sector, residents of Greater China, that would include Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan, and overseas Chinese of foreign nationalities, or Chinese nationals living overseas. And so organizationally, there are in fact 9 bureaus within the Work Department that focuses their work on each specific constituent to win them over and so forth. And so if you look at that target list, there's clearly an external component to the United Front Work Department. And so the writings talk about a strategy of 2 perimeters, meaning that there's 1 perimeter that's focused on the mainland, and then there's another broader perimeter, which is the rest of the world. And it's also important to note that in terms of the Work Department's external work, that their conception, its conception of its own writ is actually quite broad. So in theory, all ethnic Chinese are potential targets. And one of the things that really jumped out at me in one of their writings is that a key mission is to protect the legitimate rights and interests of overseas Chinese. And that's not surprising that analysts of United Front say that, you know, China is really engaging in activities that verges on extraterritoriality, right? Because it really is a broad conception of who might be legitimate targets. And for me, for someone who really spent most of his time studying the Chinese Navy, this idea of legitimate rights and interest resonates, or at least rings alarm bells with me, because when the Chinese make these excessive maritime claims in maritime Asia, they also say that China is trying to defend their legitimate maritime rights and interests, mm-hmm. which are broad, ambiguous, frequently excessive, ambiguous enough that China can really say anything to include in this idea of rights and interests. And so that would be my answer to that mm-hmm. question.
Well, but you also draw a distinction between offensive and defensive. So can you just kind of go over really what the distinction is and, you know, and why that sort of matters in our assessment of political warfare operations?
Yeah, so I think there is this important point, which is that the United Front is clearly going global, that second perimeter that I talked about. And, you know, it's important to note that this isn't new. The United Front sought to cultivate relations with overseas Chinese businesses to reconnect the Chinese economy to the rest of the global economy as early as the late 1970s. As early as September of 1977, Deng Xiaoping, in meeting visiting overseas Chinese, basically said that we need to revive and reinstitutionalize the overseas Chinese work. And that was a clear signal that he was going to turn his back on the radicalism of the Cultural Revolution. But the idea of this offense-defense thing is that the idea is that the best form of defense is a good offense, which is this idea that China needs to take the ideological struggle overseas, take the fight out there to win the hearts and minds of various audiences, to defend China's policies, China's worldviews, China's ideas, China's image by engaging in a variety of audiences, including local civic organizations, to promote China's view on things on Taiwan, the One Country, Two Systems, and increasingly these days, they're out there promoting the Belt and Road Initiative. So in my view, it is a form of, it's a non-material form of power projection. And in that sense, there's an even more fundamental goal, in my view, which is, to borrow from Professor Aaron Friedberg from Princeton, is that the goal is to make the world safe for authoritarianism. United Front seeks to influence debates and policies in ways that make the external security environment more amenable to the CCP's policies, but also, importantly, more amenable to the very nature of the regime. So you want to get countries that are not like-minded or don't share your values, like Western democracies, to see the CCP as a partner, as a business partner, to see it in a relationship that's largely transactional, very business-like, and to get those to stop viewing China through the lens of ideology, to convince others that China has a superior mode of governance and a model for development, and to align views with those that agree with or conform to China's worldview. And I think when we think about the broader illiberal trends that we see in international system, to borrow a Soviet phrase, it's that what we're seeing is the correlation of forces shifting in China's favor. And so, again, these are presumably defensive goals, right? China is trying to maintain the survival of the party to defend China's interests. But for those on the receiving end of political warfare, it's clearly quite offensive.
Well, thank you, Toshi. And you touched on this briefly in your opening statement, but perhaps you can maybe elaborate a little bit more on this. Is that how is the CPP organized to wage political warfare?
Well, I think it's important to note that the phrase that you used, magic weapon, that actually has a really long, long history. So it actually emerged. Well, first of all, let me just talk about the idea, right? Which is that this idea of the United Front emerged in the early 1920s. In fact, it emerged within the year of the party's founding, which was to essentially form an alliance of convenience with the party's arch rival, the Nationalists, and then to eat away at the enemy from the inside out. I kind of think of this as almost like a biological virus, like the Ebola virus, that infects the host and eats the host from the inside out. This is importantly a Leninist idea. And the Chinese used this idea very explicitly through the first United Front that ended in disaster in 1927, the second United Front in the war against Japan, and then through a post-revolution China. So I want to get back to this point about magic weapon, which is that it was first used actually by Mao Zedong in October of 1939. And he said basically that there are three ways to think about the standing up of the Chinese Communist Party, and there are three magic weapons. One is the United Front, the second is armed struggle, and the third is party building. So in many ways, these three magic weapons parallels the way the party today seeks to maintain power, which is, again, through propaganda, through the PLA, and through personnel selection. And so I think we have to think about United Front as a magic weapon in that context, that it is organized really to essentially seek to maintain the power of the party. And I think the other point to make is that the United Front as a concept is really deeply embedded in the party's institutional memory and history.
You know, we're often very focused in our discussion now about, you know, how CCP political warfare is influencing our society internally, and literally less about activities that it has internationally, right? And you wrote something that I found very interesting in your report, and I quote here, part of Xi's vision appears to be fostering a growing group of like-minded revisionist countries that, over time, may constitute an international partnership, alliance, or even a China-centered empire. That's very interesting. Can you articulate that thought some more so that we can better understand what the international dimensions of this of CCP political warfare?
Yeah, so I think I'm just going to, I mean, in some ways repeat what I've just stated earlier, which is that there's clearly an external dimension to United Front work, and that one of the key goals is to use United Front tactics to essentially realign the views of those external to China to make them view China's policies more favorably. And so, again, if you have countries that share your values, and the more that they share your values in number, the better it is. So I think, again, you can think about that alignment in terms of, you know, correlation of forces. So as long as there are more, if there are more illiberal regimes that shares China's viewpoints, then that's all to the good, because it actually makes it more favorable in terms of China's security.